Peppering your conversation with foreign words or phrases lends you a certain je ne sais quoi, but the words you use might not mean what you think they mean. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. English language expert Patricia O'Connor is here today. She's the author of Woe Is I and a number of other books about the English language, and she blogs at grammarphobia.com. This hour, we'll talk about foreign words, spellings, and pronunciations commonly used or misused in American English. And we'd love to hear about your favorites or least favorites. Talk of Iowa at iowapublicradio.org. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. A word or phrase that sounds foreign may be intriguing to your ear. An unconventional spelling might look sophisticated, but our English language expert Patricia O'Connor is here today to deliver some words of caution. She is the author of Woe Is I and a number of other books about the English language. She blogs at grammarphobia.com. Hello, Pat.
Hi, Charity. How are you?
Good. Thank you so much for being here today.
My pleasure.
And let's start with spellings, non-standard spellings, or spellings that we think look like something else that might lend, let's say, a store some sophistication.
Right. Well, there's a new mall near where I now live, and it's so huge that it's divided up into neighborhoods. And one of these is called the Shoppies. Every time I drive by it, I feel a twinge of annoyance. Now, a retail store that calls itself a shoppy, and here I'm pronouncing the E, so you can tell which spelling I'm referring to, S-H-O-P-P-E. It's apparently trying to add a bit of class or old world charm to the establishment.
I mean, it makes me think, okay, they're trying to convey something about this so that it's supposed to be a little old fashioned and traditional and maybe British.
If it's in some shiny glass and steel boutique, doesn't it seem a little bit out of place? this shoppy spelling, a lot of people think it's the way people talked in or wrote in Robin Hood's day. But this shoppy did not exist in Old English.
Really?
No. In Anglo-Saxon times, the word was spelled shioppa. Well, it sounded like shioppa. It was spelled S-C-E-O-P-P-A. But it was rarely used. In fact, there's only one instance of it in all of Old English writing, only one. And it's a biblical reference to the temple treasury where visitors left their gifts. And it was spelled, as I say, as it shioppa. The word didn't show up again until the late 13th and early 14th centuries, and it was spelled many, many different ways because spelling wasn't, standardized.
Right.
But mostly it was spelled S-H-O-P.
Really? Now, already?
Yes. Now, I'm not saying that S-H-O-P-P-E never appeared. It did. But the usual spelling was the normal shop with no E at the end. Now, I did a count of citations in the Oxford English Dictionary, and plain old shop has been the most popular spelling from the Middle Ages and into modern times.
All right, so if it was good enough for Chaucer, then it should be good enough for us.
Exactly. Now, why would modern retailers land on this? It turns out it's just a sheer affectation. It apparently gained in popularity with the commercial establishments in the early 20th century, around the post-World War I period. And we found several complaints about it in the 1920s. People started noticing it and making fun of it. And I even found a poem in the Saturday Evening Post in 1926. I'll read it to you. It's funnier if you see it printed because you see all those extra E's. But here it is. Ye gods, where'er I move or stoppy, I see a sign that marks a shoppy, a beauty shoppy, a shoppy for food, a bookie shoppy for the reading mood, a notion shoppy, a shoppy for gowns, a mappy shoppy, guides for roads and towns. And it goes on at length. But
you would think it would have been stamped out of usage then.
Oh, I know. I know. You would think people would have felt it was, you know, so out the wazoo or whatever. But at any rate.
And I'm sure I have to have a disclaimer here. I'm sure there are lots of wonderful stores that have that spelling.
Oh, no doubt. No doubt. They can't help it. But sometimes where you see the word shoppy, you also find the word oldie. That is old, spelled with an E at the end.
Like a ye old, oldie ye, shoppy.
Right. Ye old light bulb shoppy, or ye old candle shoppy, whatever. Now, this spelling of old is another archaism that's used affectedly by commercial establishments. And the word old was never spelled with an E in Old English again. The usual spelling was A-U-L-D, as in Auld Lang Syne. Now, the oldie spelling did occur now and then in the 14th and 15th centuries, but it was not the usual spelling, and it was long dead by the time the colonists arrived in America. So any New England inn or tavern that calls itself Ye Oldie something or other, even if George Washington slept there, is stretching the point.
So do we know where that came
from? It was adopted in the late 19th century, first as a jocular sort of reference to olden times, and later it was used commercially. I think a lot of the kinds of businesses that used shoppy used oldie, which brings us to ye, the pseudo-archaism for the word the. Now, this has no historical justification whatsoever. Ye was a pronoun, one of the four old forms of the pronoun you. It was never an article, the, in either Old English, Middle English, or any other English. And this is how the mistake happened. It was a mistaken interpretation of Old English writing. At one time, the article the, or the, you pronounce it differently according to the word that follows, it began with an Anglo-Saxon rune called a thorn, which represented a TH sound. Now, this thorn looked something like a P, with a lowercase p, with both an upper and a lower stem, like a P with a long line along the side of it. When this was copied by scribes, it sometimes resembled a backwards Y. And even after this rune was replaced by TH, and this was way back in the 13th century, the 1200s, the old letter resembling a backward Y was sometimes used in abbreviations for the. And since it wasn't available in printers' fonts, printers used Y instead. But the word was always spoken as the or the, never ye.
Interesting.
Yeah.
It's so fascinating how something like that, when it disappeared so very long ago, mm-hmm. can be brought back.
Right. Now, there's some other affected language I'd like to mention, and this is imitation French.
Well, you know, should we talk a little bit more about spelling first? Because I would love to hear your thoughts about sometimes we like to use what we consider to be British spellings to lend our establishments a little bit more sophistication.
Sure.
And
sure.
One you see quite a lot is spelling theater. Yes. R-E instead of E-R. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, there's been a lot of nonsense written about those two spellings for theater, the E-R versus R-E. For example, some people insist that E-R spelling is for movies and that R-E is for plays, or that one refers to a building and the other refers to an art form, or that one spelling is lowbrow while the other is more refined. And none of those notions is correct. They're merely variant spellings of the same identical noun, and no matter how you spell it, the meaning is the same. Now, theater with an R-E is currently the only one recognized in Britain, and theater with an E-R is the traditional American spelling, though over here, both versions are acceptable, according to standard dictionaries. You can use either one that you want.
Not in spell check, can you?
Well, I don't know about spell check. All spell checks are different, you know, depends on your computer. But I suspect that many Americans lean toward the R-E spelling because, well, it's for the same reason that the spelling of color, C-O-L-O-U-R, appeals to cosmetics manufacturers. It's that the British Association gives it a snob appeal. Now, the truth is that in British English, the spelling of theater has fluctuated over the centuries, and the R-E spelling has not always been the preference.
Hmm.
For example, Chaucer, writing in Middle English in the late 1300s, did spell theater R-E. That was probably under the influence of Old French, because that wasn't too long after the Norman conquest. But 200 years later, Shakespeare and Spenser were writing theater with an E-R, and it remained that way until the 1700s, so when it changed back to R-E. Now, in case you're wondering why it went back and forth, well, it went back to R-E in the 18th century, because during that time, all things French were fashionable among the English upper classes. French spellings crept into the language because French became the language of diplomacy early in that century, and it was inevitable that French spellings would creep in.
So the British were trying to pretend that they were French, and we're trying to pretend that we're British.
Right. But see, this the change from R-E spellings to E-R spellings happened in Britain mostly between 1720 and 1750. This was after the American colonies were established. So the colonists brought with them the older E-R spelling.
Interesting.
Yeah, so this is why you see in British English spellings ending in R-E for words like center, fiber, luster, and why you find O-U-R spellings in words like color, honor, and neighbor, while Americans kept the older spellings.
That's so interesting, because I guess I just always assumed that the British was the older way and somehow we adapted it.
In some cases, as in theater, when it came from Old French, originally it had an R-E ending. But the pattern for Latin borrowed words that come into English or come into when Latin is handed down, generally in Romance languages, the R plus a vowel spellings were kept, while in the Germanic languages like English, it was vowel R, like E-R. For instance, in German, Dutch, Swedish, Norwegian, etc., theater is spelled T-E-R, not T-R-E.
All right. So R-E is not wrong, but it sounds like it may be a little bit of a pet peeve for you.
Correct.
All right. We're going to take a short break. We will be back in just a moment. We're talking today about some of the foreign words, pronunciations, spellings that we adopt into American English. And a little later on, we'll find out that some of the things that we say commonly don't actually mean what we think they mean. We'd also love to hear from you with your questions and your pet peeves. Or if you'd like to argue with Pat for an R-E ending, you can give that a try, too. Patricia O'Connor, our English language expert, is here today. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Our English language expert, Patricia O'Connor, is here today. She's the author of Woe is I and a number of other books about the English language. She blogs at grammarphobia.com. And she's here today, of course, to answer your questions and talk to you about your language pet peeves. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And this hour, we're talking about adopting foreign words, phrases, pronunciations, or spellings into American English. And so far, we've talked a lot about spelling. Let's talk about pronunciation next, Pat.
Okay. one of my little hobby horses has always been the pronunciation of the word that's spelled H-O-M-A-G-E. When I hear homage, the French spelling, somehow it tells me something about the speaker. Now, homage, the two traditional spellings in both British and American English have always been homage and homage. You can pronounce the H or not as you like, but the accent is on the first syllable. Now, this is a word that's been part of English for 800 years, and it's always been accented on the first syllable. But I'm sorry to say that in the dictionaries very recently, in fact, only in online versions of Merriam-Webster's dictionaries, will you find that they now accept the homage pronunciation, which is French. And in my opinion, that's too bad. There is no reason to use a French pronunciation unless you're speaking French, in my opinion. We don't say toilet for toilet. I think homage sounds affected, and there are no grounds for claiming that it has precedence over the English pronunciation because the ultimate source is Latin, in which the H is pronounced.
Very interesting. And, now, yes. Pat, of course, as a broadcaster, when I see that word, I think, can I rewrite
now, what
it?
What am I going to say?
Right. But also,
what do you say?
Well, that's, I've said it different ways over the years because it seems to be one of those things. Homage is a pronunciation that I hear a lot more often these days.
And so that's why it has now been adopted as an okay pronunciation by Merriam-Webster's. And so there's nothing wrong with it. Officially, it's been sanctioned by Merriam-Webster's. Of course, if you use other dictionaries like American Heritage, you won't find that pronunciation in there.
And you're going to continue to fight the good fight.
Well, I will. I will always prefer homage or homage. And, what is it about foreign pronunciations? I don't know why people seem to think that they're more bona fide somehow. In fact, you'll find people saying bona fide. They are more bona fide somehow than American pronunciations or even British. The British generally have not said homage until recently. And I actually had somebody write to me once, and he tried to justify it by saying, well, if you're talking about a cinema director and he has a reference in one of his films to some other a director that he admires, then that's an homage. It's not a homage.
Because it's in a film?
Yeah, why? I mean, why is always a very good question to ask with language, I think.
And it's such a fun psychological question, because as you've said many times when people call in to share their pet peeves about how our language is changing, mm-hmm. you have pointed out many times that the language continues to evolve.
So, well, I have to accept that.
Right. We all have to accept that as hard as it can be.
Right.
But it is a really interesting psychological question because, is it some sort of intellectual inferiority complex on the part of Americans we like to adopt
Americans
these?
Americans have always had an inferiority complex about American English as compared with British English. It's completely
encouraged by the British, I think.
Oh, definitely. Even the Queen has commented about barbarisms in American English, and unfairly, I think. But
all right, well, set us straight on a couple of other words, because
okay, well, here's one. I don't know if I've ever talked on the show about the word that's spelled N-I-C-H-E.
I don't know either.
Okay. Well, you probably would have remembered, but because you would have remembered my rant.
All right, let's hear it.
For hundreds of years, this word in English has been properly pronounced niche. Now, a lot of people say niche, and they look down on people who say niche. In fact, I think it was Paula Abdul once on some awards show, I don't know, Grammys maybe, said niche, and she got tweeted to death by people who thought she was illiterate. She should have said niche. Well, no, actually, for most of its history, niche has rhymed with ditch. It did enter English from French in the 17th century. But once a word comes into English, it becomes English. And whatever pronunciation English people use becomes the accepted pronunciation. And for about 300 years, English pronouncing dictionaries consistently said it should be spoken as niche. Now, English-speaking people only started saying niche in the 20th century, perhaps because they thought it sounded more stylish, or because the word had French roots, or both. And because this niche pronunciation became so popular and so common, today's dictionaries do now accept that as a proper English pronunciation, because English changes, common usage rules, and so on. But we should never look down on someone who says niche, because that was the accepted pronunciation for hundreds of years, and it still is given first in modern English and American dictionaries.
All right. Well, thank you for that one, because it's another one I encounter and I think, which way am I going
to
say
I
that?
I know, you're going to hesitate to say niche because you will think that your listeners think that you're not au courant. So
but then I'll think about Janet Jackson and I'll think, yes. I'm in good company.
Yes, niche, yes.
All right. We have a lot of people on the line. We've got a lot more things to talk about, but also I know a lot of people want to be a part of this conversation. Mm-hmm. So let's get to Bruce in Des Moines. Hi, Bruce.
Hi, I'm going to have to buy your book. It's hitting so many of the things that bug me. But I had a question for you. I had always heard that Daniel Webster deliberately changed the spelling on some British words following the Revolutionary War when he published his dictionary. Mm-hmm. I just wondered if there was any truth to that.
Well, it was Noah Webster. He was the lexicographer, right? Daniel Webster was the politician. But this is what happened. I mentioned earlier that the British adopted a lot of French spellings in the 1700s. Well, Daniel Webster in the 1700s was living in the United States and observing these trends among the British. And he didn't change anything back. What he recommended was sticking with the established spellings that Americans had brought with them. He felt that to adopt a new French spelling of a word that had long been pronounced with an E-R instead of an R-E, or with an O-R instead of an O-U-R, was a corruption of the language. And so when he started publishing his spelling books and his grammars in the late 1700s, and when he published his first dictionary in the early 1800s, he stuck with those old original spellings. He didn't change anything back.
Interesting. So when we have a question about whether we should spell theater with an R-E or an mm-hmm. E-R, we should invoke our revolutionary forefathers stick with the E-R. It's a matter of pride. We won that war.
Right. It's the American way.
All right, Bruce, what a great question. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And we have a really interesting thought about a phrase that a lot of people use in American English. And this is from Matthew regarding double entendre versus double entente. And he says, per Wikipedia, the expression comes from French double, and entendre, to hear, but also to understand. However, the English formulation is a corruption of the authentic French expression, a double entente, which
yes.
I'm saying like
right.
an Iowan, double meaning. Modern French uses double sens instead. The
right.
phrase double entendre has no real meaning in the mm-hmm. modern French language, and as a Frenchman, double entendre irks me for sure.
Mm-hmm. Actually, he's absolutely right. The usual French version was double entente, which means a double understanding or an ambiguity. It has nothing to do with any sexual sense. And the term double entendre was introduced in English. Oh, my husband is just saying I misspoke and said Daniel Webster. I didn't. I said Noah Webster. Oh, did I?
Yeah, it's all right.
If I switched to Daniel, I was wrong.
We knew what you meant.
Okay, but back to double entendre. it is imitation French. And it's not the only example in the language of where English-speaking people have taken French words and created expressions that don't mean that in French. Another example is nom de plume. The French never use nom de plume to mean a pseudonym. The French term was nom de guerre, which literally means war name. and the French initially used it for the fictitious name that a soldier often adopted on enlisting. But by the time the British started using nom de guerre, it could mean any assumed name, English as well as French. And in the 19th century, some British writers apparently thought the original French nom de guerre might be confusing. So the fake French nom de plume, name of pen, literally, was introduced. It was in the 1850s, probably by an obscure Victorian novelist named Emerson Bennett. And the term caught on in literary circles, and it inspired an English translation, pen name, in the 1860s. So that's how we got pen name. It was a translation of a fake French expression that had been invented in English.
That is so interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, nom de plume sounds legit.
Yeah, and it is. The elements are French, but that's not how the French used it.
Interesting. That's
now,
so interesting.
You know, we'd love to invent French terms. Like, have you heard the word pépier?
Yes.
You have.
Yes. So, and it's it means the person who in the restaurant.
He comes at you with a baseball bat that's actually
a giant pepper grinder. Okay.
Yeah, it's a semi-humorous American invention. It only, I think it was first recorded in like 2006 or something.
So it's new.
It's modeled on the term for a wine waiter, sommelier, which comes from the French word for a butler. And if you think pépier is sort of taking division of labor to an extreme, there's another one, even more recent, sommelier. Can you guess what that means?
I have no idea.
The French word selm, which means salt. A sommelier is a person who comes around at a restaurant and helps you choose the perfect gourmet salt to go with each dish. You know, you might want Himalayan pink, or you might want, you know, those exotic black salts, or I don't know, whatever. But we don't call these people pepper waiters or salt waiters. We have to invent a French term, pelmier, selmier.
Oh, funny.
I know. Just yesterday I was reading about a marketing study that was done in the 1990s that showed that giving any product a French-sounding name, but especially a product in the field of cosmetics, chocolates, fashion, or accessories, giving any of those a French name makes them more appealing to consumers. They sell better if they sound French. And you see a lot of French spellings in ad copy in the last maybe 30, 40 years, or French spellings as borrowed by the British. For instance, have you ever noticed that in glossy magazines, when you look at ads for lipsticks, nail polish, makeup, and hair products, and so on, they never use the spelling color, C-O-L-O-R. They always use C-O-L-O-U-R, unless it's some sensible company like Burt's Bees or something like that. I mean, if it's a glossy, you know, high-end advertiser, they will use color, C-O-L-O-U-R. You'll also find phrases like creme riche, you know, the usual English words. Both here and in Britain are cream, spelled C-R-E-A-M, and rich, spelled R-I-C-H. But you never see rich cream. You always see creme riche, you know, for something you're supposed to put on your face. It's crazy. I've even seen couleur, C-O-U-L-E-U-R, the actual French spelling.
Wow. That's
it's
so
crazy.
Interesting. All right, let's get back to the phones. Lori is on the line in Columbus Junction. Hi, Lori.
Hi.
Hi.
I am an educator, and I go crazy when I see these texting, and I just wondered how you feel about the massacre of American English, not just in texting, but in signs where they spell words so they all start with the same letter and they're all incorrect.
Yeah, I don't know. Nothing could be done about this, so how I feel about it matters almost not at all. But this was bound to happen in texting because you have to change your keyboard. You have to toggle between keyboards to use punctuation or to use letters instead of numbers. So if people are already on the letter field, they're going to use you know, the digit 2 instead of T-O or T-O-O. So I think it's sort of built into the technology that that people are encouraged to use no capital letters, no punctuation.
And, of course, it bleeds off of your devices because people want to look current and hip.
But exactly.
Now, I know, Lori, as a teacher, that there's probably a serious concern. Do you feel like young people are actually not learning the correct spellings for things?
Well, that's a good question. You know, I think some young people probably know that they're using a hip spelling and that it deviates from the norm used by mom and dad and the teachers, although maybe mom and dad do the same thing. But there probably are a lot of kids who are just going to go continue communicating that way, which is a shame.
Well, I'm hoping that the rise of voice to text will bring us back a little bit, because that certainly seems to, if it recognizes the words, it spells them right. It doesn't always recognize the words. All right, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. Our English language expert, Patricia O'Connor, is here today. She blogs at grammarphobia.com. And you can join the conversation at 866-780-9100 or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Our English language expert, Patricia O'Connor, is here today. And we've been talking about how in American English, we seem to like to adopt foreign words, phrases, foreign spellings, foreign pronunciations to make ourselves sound a little more sophisticated. Sometimes we've learned we even make up foreign sounding phrases that don't mean anything in the language that we're trying to emulate. You are welcome to join our conversation with your questions, with your stories. If you want to argue with Pat for the spelling that you love or the pronunciation that you love, you can give that a try as well. 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And we do have a lot of people who want to join this conversation, Pat. So let's get to Lisa on the line in Des Moines. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, good morning. I want to know what happened to the German umlaut and the sort of guttural that came with that, and I'll take my answer.
Okay, well, wait a second, just in case Pat needs to clarify. You mean what happened to it?
The pronunciation? Is that what you're talking about?
Using it in spelling and the pronunciation.
Oh.
Mostly the spelling, the double I's.
For the most part, when you know, English is a Germanic language, but for the most part, it didn't adopt the umlaut. So that didn't come into it.
So that just as the languages
just
went their separate ways.
When we adopt words from French, we don't adopt the accent marks. In general, we don't. Unless we adopted them in modern English, where for, you know, I'm trying to think of an example, cliché came into the language fairly late, and so we kept the way the French were writing it. But usually early on, way back in the language, and, you know, English being Germanic, it's been German since the, you know, 500s, we didn't adopt the umlaut. So,
all right. Well, Lisa,
I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, thanks a lot for your call, Lisa. And now, of course, we have so many influences in the United States from people all over the world, and we have different sort of dialects that have developed. Mm-hmm. I mean, people use the term Spanglish to describe sort of a mashup of Spanish and English. Do you see that influencing American English?
Oh yeah. We've adopted a lot of words from the immigrant streams that have come to this country. For instance, all the Spanish. A lot of it was picked up in the Southwest by cowboys and whatnot. Rodeo, words like that, and immigrants coming in from Eastern Europe, Africa even, they've all brought parts of their language with them. And the when those pieces of new pieces of language proved to be valuable, useful, to the existing population, they became absorbed into the language. And that's really one of the strengths of American English, in my opinion. Well, English in general is very adaptable, but American English, because of all the immigrant activity we've had since the beginning, but especially from the mid-19th century onwards, it's strengthened the language. It's given us a lot of interesting stuff. Yiddish.
Alan in Mason City sent an email about mm-hmm. Yiddish. He says many Yiddish words have crept into our everyday language.
Oh, yes.
Words like schlep and tushy, uh-huh. plots, schmo, and many others.
Right.
And not nice ones, too, he
I
says.
I know, and many that when I first moved to New York from Des Moines in the early 80s, I was using a lot of Yiddishisms that I didn't know were naughty words.
Right.
People had to say, no, you shouldn't say that word so loudly. And I thought it just meant, a jerk, when actually it meant, some part of the anatomy that wasn't very polite
right,
to say
right.
aloud.
Well, Larry in Alden would like you to discuss the word O-E-U-V-R-E.
Oeuvre. Now, there's a French word. I mean, you could hardly mistake it for anything else. It has different pronunciations. I'm looking at American Heritage right now to see what some of the acceptable ones. I hear oeuvre a lot. Let me see. Here it is. Oh, there's only one here. Oh, no, there are two. Oeuvre. I also see oeuvre. I see oeuvre. I hear a lot of different ones. But, yeah, it's from French, and it means work, as in the noun work, a work. And it comes from the Latin opera, which is the plural of opus. Now, that brings up an interesting subject. I bet you didn't know that opera was actually a plural.
I did not know that.
We use it as a singular, of course, to mean one work, but actually in Latin it meant plural works. So,
all right.
The same is true of agenda. It used to be a plural in English. It used to mean items on a list. But now we use it in the singular to mean the list itself, or a book where you keep a list of things. So this is how language changes. And I should just relax about homage, I suppose, and niche. I should practice what I preach and just go with the flow.
Right. Here's a question from Jodine. And this is an interesting question, because a lot of us also need to use Latin words and phrases in everyday life. Scientific names are uh-huh. Latin, of course, and Jodine works with raptors, and she wants to know how to pronounce Buteo. It's the first part of the Latin name for red-tailed
oh.
hawk.
Well, I think, don't scientists usually say buteo or buteo?
I'm not sure.
Oh, well, let me look at, I'm not sure it's going to be in my dictionary, but I've always said buteo, and I think it gave us the word buzzard or bustard in British English. Wait, I'm looking here for buteo. Not finding it. But I think it's buteo or buteo. No. Sorry.
It's all right.
Things I
it's all right. You can't do everything? That's very difficult to accept. Here's an email from Kevin. I hate the phrase anhistoric. I was always told that the an was only for a silent H, like honor, etc. Since in England, historic has a silent H, but here in the States, it's a hard H.
Yeah. Oh, you know what? I just found buteo. And I find that I'm saying it wrong. Buteo. Buteo.
Buteo.
Okay, so there I go. Buteo.
All right.
B-Y-O-O. Buteo.
So okay. You can
it's
answer
a
every question.
Falcon.
All right.
Yeah. Okay, on to anhistoric.
Yes.
This has been another one of my hobby horses, because historic does not begin with a vowel sound. it begins with a consonant sound, like a bird or a shoe, a historic event. People who put an in front of historic are assuming that they're using a British usage, because you do see it a lot that way in older English writing. That was when the H wasn't pronounced in British English, and sometimes it wasn't pronounced. So people would say an historic occasion. It's an historic occasion, or this is an historic site. But the H is properly pronounced in British English. The Oxford English Dictionary says that the H is properly pronounced, so it's historic. So the proper article is the article A, not
All
the
right.
article an.
You and Kevin are on the same page.
Yes,
there.
We are on the same page. I've even written about it on my blog, so
All right.
several times.
and you sound like you're ready to do it again.
Yes.
All right, Gary is on the line. Hi, Gary.
Hello. I have two names of two cities. In Arizona, it's pronounced Prescott, and the other city is pronounced Prescott. They're both exactly spelled the same.
Prescott.
And over here in Iowa, we have Nevada, and it's spelled just like Las Vegas, Nevada.
We also have Madrid.
Yeah.
It looks like it should be Madrid.
And don't forget Tripola. Tripola. It's spelled exactly like Tripoli.
And it's pronounced Tripola? That I didn't know. I thought it was Tripoli.
Nope.
Aha. Aha. And Indiana has Versailles.
Right.
Versailles. It's actually supposed to be Versailles. I mean, it was after Versailles, but Versailles. Well, this is, as I've written about this subject on the blog, too. The proper pronunciation of a place name is the common pronunciation used by people who live there. So people who live in Prescott will pronounce it Prescott. People who live in Prescott pronounce it Prescott, and it's correct for those places. So I can't really say that people who say Versailles in Indiana are incorrect. They're not incorrect, or that Madrid is incorrect, or Tripola. Whatever is correct is the common pronunciation in those parts.
All right. Nevada is right. Madrid is right. Tripola is right. Yeah,
exactly.
And that's.
But if overnight everyone changed,
that would also be right.
Yeah, you're right.
It's a real challenge for people who move to a new place, because then you have to learn to say things like the locals when the spelling tells you something completely different. That's hard for people who move to Iowa. It was hard for me when I moved to Michigan. Let's go to Ben on the line in Des Moines. Hi, Ben.
Good morning.
Hi. What would you like to talk about?
I'm a singer, and I've got a pet peeve about, particularly since the Star Spangled Banner has been taken over by pop culture, the pronunciation of the word perilous.
Perilous?
When they get to that through the perilous fight, through the perilous fight, it almost always now becomes perilous fight, perilous. Yeah.
Instead of perilous, it's perilous. Is that it?
Peril,
P-E-R-I-L-O-U-S. Perilous.
So for all the singers out there, if you get the chance to sing the Star Spangled Banner, it's perilous fight.
What a
Thank
nice
you very
voice.
Much.
Yes, very nice. Or we can invite you to come do it. That sounds like a great plan.
Yes.
So I'm available.
Do you do it at baseball games?
Yeah.
You do? Good.
So anyway, there's not much more to say about that, just that if people could try to work on that.
All right.
Okay.
We will all try to work on that. But and pronunciation does evolve, not just so we try to sound French, but just as our letters change. And also, I mean, things sound different in different parts of the country.
Yes, they do. And that's one of the reasons why, since Glenn brought up singing, choral singers often have like books of choral pronunciations, words that are pronounced, always pronounced this way in singing, because if everyone used their different accent, it wouldn't be crisp and clear in the song.
Mm.
And I also once did a blog item about that, about certain words that are like, for instance, the word S-T-E-W. Take that as an example, like a soup. Most of us would say stew.
Right.
But a choral singer in a formal chorus would say stew if that word were in a song, say an old hymn, stew, or Tuesday, or Duke for Duke. And they do that deliberately so that everyone will sound alike.
Okay.
Which I think is interesting.
It that is
They don't want us to sound mushed.
All right. Do you ever find that bleeding over into pronunciation in yes. conversation?
Yes, I do. I get emails from people who sing in choruses who say, no, the word Tuesday is pronounced Tuesday. I may be stepping on your toes there, Charity, because I know a lot of broadcasters give that Y inflection in words like stew.
Oh. I have no idea if I do or not.
And news. They say news instead of news.
Well, I don't think.
You don't say
so.
News? Well,
news.
You aren't a newscaster. But
I used to be. All right, let's get back to the phones. Tim is on the line in Mason City. Hi, Tim.
Hello. How are you doing today?
Good. What's your question?
Well, one of my favorite French sayings is "Le street de l'escalier," which means the spirit of the stairway, and refers to when someone makes a derogatory mm-hmm. or nasty remark to you, and you can't immediately think of a retort.
Right.
Seconds
right.
later.
But you think of it later. Yes.
Is that Molière or Voltaire?
I don't know, but I do know that it's probably 17th century, something like that. But yeah, it's the retort that you couldn't think of on time. And I wish that we had an expression in English for that, but the French do.
But it's not a common enough expression that
no.
if you use that, we would know what you were talking about.
No.
Not like some of the ones that do get used, like joie de vivre or je
right.
ne sais quoi, where you don't
right.
have to be a French speaker to know what someone's trying to
yes.
say.
Yes.
All right. Well, that would be a good thing. We should work on that.
Yes. That would be a good phrase to get into your vocabulary. But I don't know if we have time. I wanted to talk about briefly, the word brassiere.
All right.
It has a French sound, but the French don't use that word brassiere. For a bra, they use the term soutien-gorge, which means a breast support. In French today, a brassiere means a baby's undershirt. Now, the reason for this is that French have used brassiere over the centuries, ever since the Middle Ages, to mean all kinds of different things. And very briefly, in the 19th century, it meant a breast support.
And all right.
Adopted into English, but they don't use it anymore.
And they've abandoned it, and we
they've
will use it,
it.
Forever.
It.
All right. Patricia O'Connor, thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Our English language expert, Patricia O'Connor, she blogs at grammarphobia.com. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.